First up, we have Yash Ratanpal and Arindam Banerjee. Yash is a qualified CERA who has worked as a consultant with several multinational and regional banks, financial conglomerates across Americas and the Asia Pacific. He has worked extensively in areas such as ALM, market risk, quantitative modeling, funds transfer pricing, treasury, derivative pricing, capital adequacy, and financial technology. He currently leads the risk consulting practice for ACS Consulting, a technology-driven advisory firm having a global presence spanning 5 countries. He has also worked as a consultant in the quantitative risk advisory practice of Deloitte India. He is currently serving as the chair of the Banking Community Leadership Team at the IFOA and a member of the Advisory Group on Banking, Finance and Investment Committee at the Institute of Actuaries of India. Arindam is the head of Global Business Development at ACS Consulting, leading sales and marketing initiatives for ACS products and services across their markets. He works closely with regional teams to drive value for their customers and deliver business growth for ACS. He also leads the ACS Alliance program, equipping partners with the right skills, systems, and support to deliver modern consulting, technology, and learning solutions to their clients. Over his career, Arindam has worked with global financial institutions, providing advisory and technology solutions in areas such as treasury, risk management, risk analytics, balance sheet management, and capital management. He has also conducted numerous knowledge-sharing workshops for industry bodies on risk and regulatory topics. Please help me welcome them to their session on leveraging ALM and IRRBB frameworks to build resilient balance sheets. Thanks.
Good morning and welcome to this session. It's a pleasure to be here. A round of thanks to Michael and the ASA body for getting us here. A quick snapshot of what we will cover today, right? Now, balance sheet management itself is a pretty broad topic. We'll start off by talking about why it's important in today's world. We'll talk about what tools are typically used by financial institutions for monitoring and measuring liquidity risk, interest rate risk, etc. We'll talk about how it has evolved over the last few years. We'll also talk about how organizations are changing to make sure that their risk exposures in these areas, specifically liquidity risk and interest rate risk, are maintained within their risk tolerances. We'll take a look at a few case studies, some of the global institutions we have worked with, what kind of frameworks they have in place, what kind of methodologies they have put in place over the last few years. And we'll summarize with a few takeaways based on industry best practices, what other players across markets are doing in response to the need for building a resilient balance sheet. Now, if I look at the construct of a financial institution's balance sheet, broadly, risk is housed in two distinct areas. One part where risk is housed are individual products, where let's say you have credit risk from a loan, you have market risk from an equity trading position, and the management of these are typically siloed as well, done within those individual institutional groups. So let's say credit risk would typically be managed by a credit risk function, which would look at credit rating models, scoring models, so on and so forth, while market risk would be taken care of by, let's say, a treasury middle office function or, let's say, a market risk department, right? We aren't going to focus today on these product-specific risks. What we will focus today is on the second part, which is where balance sheet risks come in. Now, balance sheet risks typically come in because of transactions executed across the entire organization, which impacts NIM, ROE, and P&L. Right? So balance sheet management's objective essentially are threefold. Number one, ensuring whatever risk appetite and exposure limits are in place, be it for regulatory requirement, be it for internal prudential requirements, they are adhered to. That's objective one. This would typically include things like LCR, things like liquidity mismatches, time bucketed mismatches, things like your duration gap, so on and so forth. The second objective is what is NIM protection. NIM protection and minimizing volatility to NIM through, let's say, hedging programs where interest rate risk is excessive, etc., is the second objective. The first and the second objective are typically taken care of by ALCO, and you typically would also have an RMC of the board which would supervise the ALCO's function, ALCO being the Asset Liability Management Committee within a financial institution. The third objective of balance sheet management is a little more broader. It's more around ROE management and ROE optimization. Over the last few years, people have also moved away from looking at ROE as a metric and started looking at ROCE as a metric, right? The difference is that ROE is, well, all equity, but what a shareholder is interested in is if I have deployed X amount of capital for a particular business line, a particular product, am I actually getting value for that, right? Now, that's the construct of balance sheet management overall, what its objectives are. We will take a look in the next slide on what a complete balance sheet management framework would look like. But we'll start off with why balance sheet management is required today. So if I look at the changing dynamics of the modern financial world, there are four distinct things which emerge, which is what you can see here. To start off with, you have interest rate interconnectedness between different jurisdictions. So it's well commonly well accepted that, you know, when the Federal Reserve in the US changes rates, there is a cascading effect across all jurisdictions, right? Part of it is to protect capital outflows. As a regulator, you don't want to have too much money effects, especially leaving the country. That's one objective, which is typically balanced by inflation internally, right? But if I look at the financial institutions profile, without a doubt, you would have institutions playing on the term structure of an interest rate curve. Now, what that means is any change in that curve has the potential to derail my NIM target. As an institution, I have certain net interest margin targets, which are largely derived from interest income less interest expense, right? If there is a change in interest income or interest expense, there is a direct impact to my NIM. And because a financial institution runs both fixed rate and floating rate pools, the management of that becomes extremely important because you need to make sure that at a whole balance sheet level, you are looking at interest rate sensitivity from the right perspective, looking at it from a repricing gap, duration gap, and now standardized EVE, which we will come to as part of this discussion. The second thing that has also happened on the back of interconnectedness is institutions which can tap overseas borrowings, especially because overseas borrowings are sometimes cheaper than domestic cost of funds, right? They will want to do that, which introduces two additional layers of complexity. Interest rate risk management needs to be done really well because you have an accounting implication from a IFRS 9 perspective and a hedge accounting perspective. That's one. The second is FX risk also comes into the picture, which you would typically want to hedge using a cross-currency swap or those kind of instruments, right? That's the first part, which is the interest rate portion. Now, the second part that you see here is the customer dynamics. Now, the impact of customer dynamics on liquidity risk has been studied for quite some time, over, I guess, 2 to 3 decades now, where you do behavioral on liquidity, so on and so forth. The impact on interest rates, not as much. And that becomes quite important because of two reasons. One, there are regulations now which require that to happen. We'll talk about that in the regulations portion. But more importantly, if, let's say, I am in a rising interest rate scenario, people who have, let's say, term deposits with an organization or an institution will want to break them and invest at the higher rate. In the same way, if I am in a volatile interest rate scenario, I, as a customer who has taken a loan, will ask for fixed rate positions or fixed rate loans rather than floating rate ones. And all of this introduces a layer of, let's say, a layer of complexity for the financial institution who now needs to manage all of this, These are no longer disparate blocks. You need to bring it all together to manage. So that's the second part, which is the customer behavior part. Coming to the third one, which is evolving regulations, broadly two sets of regulations have come out in the last 5 to 7 years, which impact the way financial institutions manage and account for NIM, right? First, you have the IRRBB guidelines, which came out, I think, in 2017, 2018, something like that, which requires standardized EVE to be calculated. And the limits that it puts on institutions is far more stringent than anything before. What it says is 15% of Tier 1 capital should not be exceeded. Otherwise, it's an outlier bank. And the moment it's designated as an outlier bank, regulatory scrutiny just shoots up, right? That's one. The second is, if I look at some of the accounting implications brought about by IFRS, of course, in IFRS 9, we are required to now move to forward-looking ECL estimates as a measure of provisions, and that already includes a macroeconomic layer to it, right? So the ability to forecast interest rates, the ability to take into account what kind of impact it will have on inflation, on GDP, et cetera, already factored in through macroeconomic variables. At the same time, from a hedge accounting perspective, if let's say you have executed an interest rate swap for hedging your interest rate risk, because so we about like 4 or 5 years back, we did a work with one of the largest Middle Eastern banks where let's say about 25% of their portfolio was a pure government grant, which was fixed rate, just fixed, right? But on the liability side, sorry, on the asset side, you did not have as much of fixed rate assets, right? The fixed rate assets was maybe 10%. So now to manage that mismatch again, you need to hedge. And if you are hedging, you need to make sure that under IFRS 9, it is an effective hedge, and you are able to factor that or account for that through your OCI correctly, OCI being your other comprehensive income. That's the third one. And finally, the fourth one is around shareholder expectations. I talked about how shareholders' expectations are shifting from ROE to ROCE. People want to see, because equity is a very base calculation, but if I look at ROCE, it also includes your Tier 1 and the other components of capital, which is what shareholders now focus on today. And their ask is very simple. When I am deploying funds to an institution, or by the same corollary, when an institution is deploying funds to its business lines, are they doing it in a manner that maximizes my ROE as a shareholder? Right? Does it take care of risk-adjusted profitability? Am I allocating capital on the basis of risk-adjusted profitability? Right? That becomes the fourth part over here. The situation is accentuated by more complex instruments coming into the market. Securitization, you have CDOs, for example, all of which impact your interest rate as well as your liquidity positions. Ensuring that from a shareholder perspective, I am earning adequate ROCE or ROE on it is one of the more important priorities from a finance and investor relations perspective. We'll just take a quick look at what a typical balance sheet management framework would entail. Right? We talked about the end objective, which is basically balance sheet planning and optimization with a goal of ROE optimization. Now, this ROE optimization can be within an institution where allocation is across different products. It can also happen if, let's say, it's a financial conglomerate. It can also happen among group entities, right? Because I may want, let's say, to allocate different types of capital and different quantum of capital to, let's say, a bank versus a non-banking lending institution versus, let's say, an insurer, a brokerage, so on and so forth, right? So this becomes important from a group perspective as well. What you see at the very bottom is the entire risk management layer from where it all starts, right? The first part of it, which is the ALM portion, this is where we'll be focusing most of our attention today, which takes care of liquidity risk and interest rate risk, the financial risk that is on the balance sheet. You also have other risks like credit, market, operational for that matter, so on and so forth, which we are not going to cover as part of today's discussion. Happy to, of course, get into that offline or, you know, in a separate forum. The journey from risk management to ROE optimization and balance sheet optimization goes through profitability and capital management. Now, what does profitability management do? Profitability management takes care of the NIM estimation at the whole balance sheet level. It takes care of the distance from NIM to ROE or ROCE, because typically a bank or an institution will also have non-interest income and non-interest expense. Right? The interest income and expense anyway is taken care of by NIM. The non-interest income and non-interest expense, fee income, for example, or let's say cost allocation for OPEX, right? You have a call center, how do you allocate costs across that? You have, let's say, a core banking system. Now, how do you allocate cost across different BUs for that software cost? All of that is taken care of in this layer. So FTP, which drives product pricing, cost allocation, as well as profitability management in one single layer here. The one above that, which is capital management, broadly has two parts. You have pillar one capital and you have ICAP or pillar two capital, broadly called regulatory and economic capital. Now, both this and this together is what will drive capital allocation. Because I know how much capital is required. I know which business units within the organization has delivered the highest risk-adjusted return. And based on that, it's an iterative optimization. Right? That's basically how the entire optimization equation works here. Right? Now, the framework, the automation around it, again, is something which is fairly well established as part of banking, or let's say large bank institutional processes. We can get into that, but the objective was to give you a sense of how it all comes together from a balance sheet management perspective. Now, stakeholders across this entire layer varies. This is typically taken care of by the risk management function, including treasury, middle office, ALM, etc. Profitability, capital, and balance sheet planning. Typically, there's a balance sheet management group which takes care of it. If the institution doesn't have a BSMG, you may have parts of this split across, let's say, a finance function or, let's say, a treasury middle office function in that sense. Yep. Perfect. Moving forward to probably the last slide before I hand it over to Yash, I just wanted to talk about the linkages between liquidity risk and interest rate risk. Right? Our focus today will be on ALM and the two components of that, which is liquidity risk and interest rate risk, do have a substantial interplay. Like I mentioned, there are certain positions on the book of a bank or a financial institution which has inherent optionality in it. For example, prepayment of a term loan. The customer always has that option, right? Unless, obviously, you have associated a cost with it to manage that risk, right? You have, let's say, premature withdrawals, right? By its very nature, that instrument has that risk associated with it. You also have certain positions like NMDs, CASA broadly, right? Your current account, savings account, which do not have a maturity associated with it. And therefore, any interest rate movements, liquidity movements will impact that no matter what. We've talked about prepayments. HQL is the other portion because interest rate movements will impact my valuations of fixed income positions, which also will impact my HQLA and therefore my LCR. Right. So in some sense, it brings together multiple elements of risk management, performance management, etc. when I talk about balance sheet management overall. What we will see in the next few slides is what are the tools typically used for interest rate risk management and liquidity risk management? How have they evolved over time? And also, when, let's say, those risk exposures are exceeded, how do institutions manage that? Right, how exactly do they go about bringing those risk exposures within the risk appetite again? Right. I'll just hand it over to Yash for this now. He'll take us through the next few slides.
Perfect. Thanks, Arunam. Thanks a lot for that. So I think good morning, everyone. Glad to see almost a full house. I think a few tables barring here. I think some of you guys have been speaking on LinkedIn or on calls, I think, since the last few years. It's a pleasure to be here in person. It's the first time for both Arunam and I in South Africa, a wonderful country. Looking forward to see most of it in the next few weeks to come. I think Arunam has already primarily spoken about why balance sheet management is important in today's day and age. He spoke about the need for resilient balance sheets. He also spoke about balance sheet management is not limited to ALM and IRRBB. Balance sheet management as a whole is a very different ballgame. It has a lot more aspects and components to it, right? But of course, today's session is focused on one part of that, which is ALM and IRRBB, which we're going to be talking about. What I'm going to be covering in the next few slides is primarily on actually getting into the nitty-gritties with respect to the methodologies, talking about how today are banks actually going about measuring ALM, liquidity risk, and IRRBB, and how these practices have evolved over a period of time. So both Arindam and I have been, and Arindam more than me, has been around, where we have been working for more than a decade in this area, across banks, across geographies. And there's a very clear trend that is essentially coming out based on our experience. The trend is quite clear. Earlier, when ALM or liquidity risk charted, or even IRRBB charted, it was primarily looked at as a, to be very honest, a compliance or a tick box exercise for regulators, right? Today, it's not the same. Banks have started realizing that getting your balance sheet management, the ALM and the IRRBB modeling correct, is absolutely fundamental to not only preserving your net worth, but also to ensure stability in your NII or earnings, right? And that's essentially what explains the evolution that we are seeing in the industry, right? Now, when I speak about the way things have evolved over time, there have primarily been three types of evolutions that have happened, right, on the ALM side. The first one is on the liquidity risk perspective. When we talk about liquidity risk, banks started off with very traditional and simplistic models, which was basically cash flow projections on a static balance sheet, and they computed high-level balance sheet ratios to give a bank an approximate strength of what is the liquidity position of the bank, right? You can think of it as a back-of-the-envelope calculation of a sort to kind of give us an idea of where do we stand from a liquidity perspective. Over a period of time, we saw what happened in the 2008 crisis, which led to Basel III essentially coming in. And there was a lot more focused on a very granular way of coming up with liquidity risk, which means now banks were asked, okay, you all were doing cash flow analysis at a static level, at an overall balance sheet level. Let's go a step further, right? Let's go and look at a product level, at a counterparty level, at a rating level, so on and so forth. And that's what kind of led to the granular computation of LCR and NSFR, where LCR focused on short-term liquidity more, and NSFR, of course, focused from a longer-term stability of funding, right? And that's essentially where banks moved to, but that was primarily regulatorily driven. What we're seeing now is that banks now, in today's day and age, especially the larger banks, are moving to a more proactive way of measuring and managing liquidity risk. We are now looking at extremely realistic stress scenarios that are being run, that are not just theoretical in nature. And these stress scenarios being linked to essentially derive early warning indicators by looking at real-time data in the market, looking at bank-specific indicators, industry-specific data, to identify early warning stress in the liquidity in the system. And based on that, banks are actually optimizing their contingency funding plans. Up till now, banks were only measuring liquidity risk, right? Now, what happens if a liquidity event happens was something which was more subjective per se. What is happening now is they've gone a step further. We're now seeing banks actually optimizing contingency funding plans, which is data-driven and in a scientific way using intelligent optimization algorithms, right? And that's where we are when we talk about liquidity as a third part. When we speak about the evolution, the second evolution that is happening, that's essentially on, I believe, the interest rate risk side, right? And we see that on the interest rate risk front, banks initially started off with repricing gap analysis, which was again a back-of-the-envelope calculation at an overall balance sheet level to say that what's the repricing gap between my assets and my liabilities. For example, there could be some fixed rate liabilities funding floating rate assets. That's a very natural interest rate risk that most banks run. Banks simply plotted the cash flows in different time buckets, assuming the floating rate positions will reprice in the next reset date. And they came up with the repricing risk for each time bucket, which gives you a good indicator of how much interest rate mismatch are banks running in their banking book. Then over a period of time, repricing gap analysis was used as a proxy to kind of derive what is the impact on my earnings or the NII of the bank. Because traditionally, when the concept of interest rate started, the focus was extremely heavily skewed towards NII itself and only on the earnings part, right? Over a period of time, regulators evolved across the globe, and they basically asked banks that interest rate risk is a two-dimensional problem. It's not just one-dimensional. We can't just focus on earnings. It has a very second and a very important aspect, which is the net worth of the bank. And I think if there's anything to go by in the last couple of years, we know what happened in the US, SVB, right? Classic example of what happens when you'll only look at interest rate risk from an earnings perspective and not from a net worth perspective, right? And that's where duration gap came into play, wherein it was an approximate way to assess the impact on the net worth of a bank by doing a modified duration gap analysis between the assets and the liabilities. But up till now, even then, for both repricing gap and duration gap, this was done at a very high level, at an overall balance sheet level, using very simplistic parallel shock scenarios that are never really realistic in what we see in the market, right? And that's essentially where we come to the third stage of evolution in interest rate risk, where things have drastically changed. With the new BCBS guideline coming in on IRRBB, which requires banks to not only focus on earnings, but also focus on net worth, with full revaluation-based simulations for EVE, which is economic value of equity, the net worth of the bank, and the NII. And these need to be done across various non-parallel shock scenarios, not just parallel shock scenarios. There are banks that I have worked with that are running around 300 to 315 interest rate shock scenarios today, right? Across all different currencies that they trade on, right? It's a very, very different ballgame to what we are seeing today. And the amount of complexity, rigor, granularity, sophistication, and the accuracy of some of the numbers that we are seeing is really astonishing, right? And for the first time, we see that interest rate risk because of IRRBB coming in is not just a tech, a check-in-the-box exercise. It's actually adding value to the bank, where they are using this to actually derive and design their hedging strategies to hedge the IRRBB in their book, right? That's the evolution on the interest rate risk side. When we talk about the third evolution that we see, that's on the balance sheet projection side. And all three of these are happening parallelly and they're integrated together, and that's why we see this evolution happening, right? On the balance sheet projection side, banks initially started off with a very simplistic view, which is a runoff balance sheet assumption, which means that once my assets and liabilities run off, I'm not going to be replacing them, right? Specifically used, even till date, done for net worth computations, because when you're doing your net worth assessment, you want to see a runoff balance sheet view, which is a very simplistic view of the balance sheet. When we talk about NII or earnings, banks used to use a very simplistic assumption called the constant balance sheet assumption, because when you're looking at NII, you want to ensure that the balance sheet is still constant so that the only impact that you're seeing on NII is because of the interest rate movements and not because of the balance sheet changing itself. So most of the banks use a very simple assumption, which is they used to do a constant replacement of assets and liabilities as and when they matured, and that's called the constant balance sheet assumption. What we're seeing now is a more sophisticated version, which again, used by mid to large sector banks, where they've integrated their entire budgeting and planning process with their ALM process. What that means is, banks are now looking at the balance sheet not just from a constant view or a runoff view. Banks are actually projecting their entire balance sheet for the next 3 to 5 years, which also is required for ICAP purposes, right? Which is for Pillar 2 capital adequacy. And using the balance sheet projections in the future, they're basically computing their forward-looking liquidity matrix, forward-looking IRRBB, using these measures so that when you're standing today, not only are you calculating your LCR standing today, you're not just calculating your NII for the next 12 months on a constant balance sheet. Today, banks are actually looking at the next 3 years, 5 years. They're seeing how their earnings are going to evolve as and when the balance sheet evolves, right? How is the evolution of the balance sheet going to be modeled? And they're integrating that with NII, which gives a very realistic picture of exactly how earnings need to be looked at. Because in reality, they're trying to say that okay, there are certain business lines and geographies where the banks are going to grow into. They're actually getting those assumptions and modeling it as part of their balance sheet projection models and using that to derive their NII and interest rate risk and liquidity risk measures, right? And that's the dynamic balance sheet approach that we are essentially seeing today. Right. So I think I gave a high-level overview of typically how the evolution has played out. Just getting into a slightly more amount of nitty-gritties, and I think this is a topic hopefully I think most since most of us are actuaries, we will appreciate this, right? We'll get into the numbers as well. There are some practical case studies I've created to not just give you all qualitative views, but also give some amount of brief in terms of how this plays out. But in terms of methodologies that banks are using today, I'll talk about liquidity risk first, and then I'll come to interest rate risk. There's been a clear evolution. What I've done is I've listed down essentially different methodologies in the order of complexity that banks are today using, right? Of course, this is not completely, I would say, holistic. There could be certain banks that are using certain other methodologies. But based on our experience, commonly, this is the key theme or the trend that we've observed across the industry, right? When we talk about liquidity, the simplistic approach that banks use is a contractual cash flow analysis. What happens in a contractual cash flow analysis mismatch is banks essentially just project the cash flows based on the contract that they have. So if they have a fixed rate loan for, let's say, 5 years, which is has a monthly repayment, they're essentially just going to forecast it for the next 5 years on a monthly basis. They're going to do the same thing for the liabilities as well. And essentially, they do a bucketing of the cash flows at a bucket level, and they compute the mismatch at a bucket level to come up with the idea that how much cash flow mismatch am I simply running, right? And this is only based on the contract that you signed with the customer, the simplistic way of doing your cash flow analysis. Relatively easy to do. Of course, the only challenge is the size of the accounts that banks run from an automation perspective, because generating cash flows is not easy, right? The more accounts that you have, it's a very cumbersome exercise, right? The second stage is behavioral cash flows, which is they adjust the contractual cash flows. As Arindam was mentioning, in reality, when interest rates change, when macroeconomic environments change, customer behavior also changes, right? What that means is there are prepayments that happen on fixed term loans when interest rates go down. There are early redemptions that increase on interest on fixed term deposits when interest rates go up, so on and so forth, right? That means, oh, even though contractually you would have signed a 5-year fixed term loan and that's on your balance sheet, if interest rate moves, essentially maybe they're going to prepay it within a year, right? Now, how do you account that into your balance sheet modeling, right? Because at the end of the day, that's what matters, not what you contractually have, right? Because contractually and theoretically, everything could be hunky-dory. When interest rate scenarios actually change, you have a very different liquidity position that you're looking at, right? And that's essentially where behavioral cash flow comes in, where there are behavioral models calibrated using statistical techniques, using regression-based models, using macroeconomic models, survival analysis method that we've studied in actuarial science that banks use across the globe to essentially come up with these behavioral models and adjust the contractual cash flows, right? And that's why it has a higher level of complexity associated with contractual cash flows. The third part is, of course, LCR and NSFR, which is as per the Basel III regulation, which is very granular, right? The reason LCR and NSFR has a higher complexity is primarily because the sheer amount of data mapping that a bank needs to do to come up with these figures at a counterparty level, at a rating level, at a product level, is very difficult, especially for banks that are running legacy core banking systems. They don't have most of these tags. So the amount of data validation, data computation required there is quite intense, right? LCR, of course, focuses on the short-term liquidity. It's a measure that helps you to come up with, do I have enough liquidity over the next 30-day period under a liquidity stress scenario, right? And do I have enough high-quality liquid assets, which is HQLA, to kind of cover up the liquidity risk that I'm running over a short-term period, right? So LCR is a short-term measure. On the other hand, NSFR is a more of a long-term measure, right? Which looks at what is the available stable funding that you have compared to the required stable funding, right? As we saw during 08-09, one of the reasons why banks failed is the heavy reliance on corporate deposits, right? Which are extremely volatile in nature. One of the themes that we are seeing, at least in India and most of the Asia-Pacific markets play out, is banks are clearly diversifying into more retail kind of deposits because they're more sticky in nature. They are less volatile, right? And essentially, NSFR would introduce with exactly that direction, right? With that aim to kind of ensure that the funding that you have, which is funding your asset side, is more stable than what erstwhile used to be there. So it's a measure of how stable your funding is. When we move on to the next one is dynamic liquidity. We spoke about the forward-looking balance sheet. All these measures that I spoke about, the contractual cash flows, the behavioral cash flows, the LCR and NSFR, can also be done on a forward-looking balance sheet, right? Wherein you're not just calculating these measures standing today on today's balance sheet, you're forecasting these measures over the next 2 years, 3 years, 1 year, right? To give you a sense of exactly how the forward-looking evolution of liquidity risk matrix is going to play out. And that's essentially the fourth methodology that banks have started using, and definitely more complex than the first three because it requires a lot of forward-looking assumptions. And the last part is contingency funding plans, which I spoke about. A lot more proactive, not waiting for liquidity events to occur and wiping you out. Coming up with an optimal contingency funding plan with different funding sources using optimization algorithms to achieve two things. One, we have enough amount of liquidity when a liquidity event occurs. Second, The cost of liquidity when a bank is under stress is extremely high, right? The reason being that the market knows that the bank is under stress. They're going to charge you an obscene amount of money and extremely high interest rates to lend you money during those difficult times, right? So what does the bank do? They have a lot of different funding sources that they need to keep aside standing today when things are good, right? And they kind of run the optimization algorithms today itself so that they already fix their position in the future that if tomorrow things go wrong, these are the specific funding sources that we're going to activate and in which order are we going to activate it so that our overall cost of bridging that shortfall during a bad liquidity event is optimal, right? That's essentially what banks are now moving towards, which is the most, I would say, the latest stage of evolution where large banks have come to, right? So that was on liquidity risk. When we speak about the evolution on the interest rate risk side, what we see is we spoke about repricing gap and approximate EAR, which were again back of the envelope calculations to do a simple repricing gap analysis at a bucket by bucket level. And then, of course, there was a duration gap analysis, which was again an approximate way of doing your net worth. Banks then moved on to doing partial and tenor wise PVO1. So while PVO1 as a measure is relatively straightforward, but banks do tenor-wise PVO1s. What that means is that for each and every tenor in the interest rate curve, the bank wants to know what is the sensitivity that they're running on that tenor, right? It's a very, very cumbersome exercise to run because large banks that are running multiple currency positions with multiple interest rate curves need to simulate this for each and every position. So think of it that you have one curve. There are 15 tenor points on that curve. For each tenor point, the bank is coming up with a sensitivity of what is our sensitivity to that. This is extremely beneficial. The reason being because when banks design their hedging strategy, right, they know exactly which tenor do they need to hedge rather than just doing a blanket PVO1 at an overall position level, right? So it's more practical in nature than just theoretical, right, which typically happens. Banks have also now started moving towards a convexity adjusted duration analysis. Of course, something that we've well read in most of our actuarial exams. Convexity, of course, is a more accurate measure of interest rate risk compared to duration, specifically when there are really large shocks and jumps in the interest rate curve, right? Because the convexity is essentially the second order derivative of duration, and it's able to capture the rate of change in duration more accurately than duration itself. And lastly, we have the EVE and the NII simulations as per IRRBB, which is where most of the large banks are now, which is a very different ballgame to what we've seen happening earlier. Requires a full revaluation of your entire banking book. You need to regenerate your cash flows multiple times for different scenarios, integrate your behavioral models within those cash flows, which need to be macroeconomic linked, and you need to have a forward-looking view when you're doing NII. So very, very cumbersome, but very value-adding in terms of what IRRBB offers, and that's where we are in the last phase. And also just to summarize, so I spoke about the evolution of liquidity risk. We also spoke about the methodologies for interest rate risk. And I had also briefly spoken about how the movement is happening from traditional ALM to a more dynamic ALM today, right? And what does that specifically mean? I'll maybe just share some insights on that. That traditionally, of course, the focus was on short-term earnings, right? Not really on economic value. In dynamic ALM, there's focus on both economic value as well as earnings, right? So not just NII, but also EVE. The stress testing scenarios in traditional ALMs have typically been very subjective and only the ones that are prescribed by regulators. Under the dynamic regime, we are seeing banks designing their own interest rate shock scenarios, going over and above what the regulator asks for, which is a lot more realistic to the specific geography and the bank's own nuances, right? Correlation between different factors typically in the traditional ALM world is not considered. How does the prepayments, early redemptions, FX rates, how are they correlated with interest rate changes, right? In a traditional ALM setup, you would put up subjective assumptions that are rigid in nature. You would not take into account the correlations and the interactions between the different risk factors. In the dynamic ALM world, you of course have to take that into account to give you a more realistic view of how the balance sheet is going to evolve. And the last part is the assumption of the static portfolio. Under the traditional ALM, you look at a static or a constant portfolio. Under a dynamic ALM, you're actually going to be looking at the evolution of your balance sheet over a period of time, and not just look at a static portfolio, essentially going on. So that's primarily to give you guys a high-level overview of how ALM, liquidity risk, and IRRBB methodologies have evolved across the globe by different banks, right? Now, to add some more color to some of what I was talking about, what I've done is created two practical case studies just to give you all give you guys an idea of how does this happen in practice, right? And how usually do banks go about using these matrix and tools, right? So we're going to talk about two case studies. One is on the liquidity risk side, and the second one is on the IRRBB side. On the liquidity risk side, we're going to look at the last methodology that I spoke about, which is the optimized contingency funding planning, because that's essentially the last stage of evolution where banks are at. So I wanted to add some more color and explain exactly how banks go about doing this, right? It's typically a four-step process. What you see at the first step is essentially banks generating at an overall balance sheet level. Banks can also do this at a product level, but for the sake of simplicity for this conference, I'm keeping at the overall balance sheet level. They're actually forecasting their total cash outflows, their total cash inflows across all the buckets in the future. So standing today, the bank is forecasting the cash flows, which are behaviorally adjusted, and they're bucketing those cash flows for the next 5 years, right? Or at least for the next 5 to 10 years. And for each bucket, with specific focus on short-term buckets, which is under 1 month, right? Because liquidity as an event, as we know, when liquidity hits banks, it's always a short-term event, right? Liquidity is not a long-term risk. Like there's a very common saying in the banking industry that if you can't survive for a week, forget about surviving for a year, right? That's essentially what liquidity risk means. So the two buckets that we look at here, we see that in this case, in the first bucket, the bank is running a mismatch of around 250 million. And in the second bucket, they're running a mismatch of around 5,000 million, right? So that's the first step, right? In this case, where they've forecasted the outflows, they've forecasted the inflows, and they've come up with the mismatches that they're running. Now, what does a bank do? They see, okay, we're running a mismatch. There are sort of, every bank has its own internal limits that they're okay with, right? No bank is going to be okay with they all have a risk appetite or risk threshold. So in this case, the bank, I'll come to that in the next slide, they're running certain risk limits and they're going to be okay with the first bucket because the mismatch, as you see here, is very minimal, right? It's not really large compared to the second bucket. So what the bank would do is, they would look at the universe of all the funding sources that are available. Now, typically, traditionally for a bank, there are different funding sources that are available. They have capital market borrowings where they can borrow from the capital markets using commercial papers, a certificate of deposits. They can raise bonds, right? The second type of borrowing could be bank lines, right? Where banks have kind of relationships with other banks where they raise money, right? Or kind of borrow from the other banks through committed bank lines. And there could also be investments that the bank have in the trading book or the banking book that can be liquidated in case of a liquidity event, right? These are the typical 2 to 3 funding sources that almost every bank has with them, right? To overcome a liquidity crisis. So what a bank typically does is they create a universe of all the funding sources at the second step, right? And each funding source has different attributes to it. For example, in this case, we have what is the interest rate cost associated with each funding source? What is the lead time? That means if I do activate that funding source today, how much time would it take for me to actually get the money into my bank, right? What's the lead time associated with that funding source? Is there a haircut on that? For example, when banks liquidate investments, these are large positions, right? They can't simply liquidate it at the market value. It's going to take an impact on the market value of the assets when they're selling. So there's a haircut assumption based on historical VAR models that banks calibrate. What's the haircut with these different funding sources? And finally, what's the maximum limit that I can draw down from that, right? Because every bank has its own funding policy, which has separate limits on how much you can raise from a concentration perspective of different funding sources. So these are the different attributes that are covered from a funding universe perspective, right? What you would see here is that we've only taken the first two buckets from the previous slide, right? Which are the short-term buckets. In the first bucket, you see we were running a mismatch of around 250 million and the second one around 5049 million, right? Now, what we see is the bank has a risk appetite internally, which says that in the first bucket, the bank is okay with a 15% mismatch. And in the second bucket, the bank is okay with a 20% mismatch from a cumulative cash flow perspective, right? So after taking into account the bank's own risk appetite statement, we see that there's no mismatch to be filled up in the first bucket, which is 1 to 14 days. However, in the second bucket, which is 14 days to 1 month, there is still a mismatch of 1,027 that needs to be filled up, right? Which goes over and above the risk appetite statement of the bank. So the question here is, how do we fill up this 1,027 in the second bucket, right? And what the bank would do is, they go back to the previous slide where we see the universe of funding sources. They design a very intelligently designed optimization algorithm, which will basically tell you that from all the universe of funding sources that I had, which are the ones that I should trigger and in which priority, right? Taking into account the lead time, taking into account the limits, taking into account the haircuts, taking into account the cost, right? Which is the most optimal funding strategy for me to overcome this liquidity risk event, right? And that's essentially where you see the optimal funding strategy, wherein these were different funding sources that we had, the respective opening balances, and we see that the bank, to overcome that 1027 shortfall, activated all the funding sources completely except the last two. The last two being a capital market borrowing and a bank line, where for the capital market one, out of the 500, only 197 was used because they only needed to use that to fill the shortfall up, right? They didn't, because the shortfall was 1027. But if you see the last bank line, it was completely not touched at all. That means the bank didn't use it. Why? Right? Because in the previous slide, when we see bank line 5, we essentially see that the cost of this bank line is the highest. It's giving at a cost of 3%. Also, the lead time for this bank line funding to come is going to take 30 days for you to come. Right? So if it's a very high cost funding source, it's going to take a lot of time for you to come in. By the time you actually activate that, you're not going to be able to fill up that gap, right? Realistically. And hence, looking at other funding sources were more optimal for this particular bank, right? And that's how they bridged that gap of 1027 using these optimal funding sources, right? What this allowed the bank to do is, tomorrow if a liquidity event occurs, they're already ready today, which is the most cost-effective way for me to liquidate my funds, right? Taking into account all the assumptions in a stress scenario. And it's also the most cost-effective way for them to do it, which preserves their NII and the ROE to their investors, right? So that's essentially the first case study that we want to speak about, which was on liquidity risk, right? The second case study that we want to talk about is on IRRBB from an interest rate risk perspective. As I spoke about the new regulations that have come in, which is on BCBS 368, we see that interest rate risk is now looked at from both an EVE perspective as well as from an NII perspective, right? And this is an illustrative output of a particular sample bank, where they ran the IRRBB scenarios. In reality, they run a lot more scenarios, but at the bare minimum, the regulator requires you to run 6 scenarios in IRRBB, which is a parallel up, parallel down, steepener, flattener, short rate up, and short rate down, right? For the sake of simplicity, I've only shown 4 of these scenarios here in this slide. What we see is, what IRRBB requires you to do as a bank, it requires you to calculate 2 measures. One is your economic value of equity, which is a value, which is essentially the net worth of the bank, right? And the second is the NII, which is the net interest income. What IRRBB requires you to do is calculate delta EVE and delta NII, which is essentially the change in EVE and NII under each interest rate scenario. So what the bank would do is, first they would calculate the EVE and NII under a baseline scenario, assuming there is no stress in the market, everything is hunky-dory, it's BAU. What's essentially your net worth? What is your NII? That's the first step that the bank does. And then for each of these interest rate scenarios, they need to revalue and rerun the cash flows for each of the scenarios and come up with a revised number for net worth and the earnings, right? The entire process of computation, the EVE, is quite cumbersome. It's very rigorous. Lot more nuances in that. But to just give you all a essence, it takes into account your future cash flows, takes into account your behavioral models, takes into account embedded optionalities within the book, right? And that's how you come up with your EVE numbers. Similarly for NII as well, you need to have a forward-looking view on the balance sheet to come up with the NII projections as well. Now, once you've done that, in this example, what we see is that for net worth specifically, after the bank ran the simulations across all the scenarios, they identified that the bank was getting hit the most under the parallel up shock scenario. So when interest rate scenarios go up parallelly, that's where the bank is going to lose 1670 USD million in terms of net worth deterioration, right? And that's called as a standardized EVE measure, because you're supposed to take the worst case change in EVE, which is going to adversely impact the bank, right? What the regulator requires the banks to do is compare this to 15% of your tier 1 capital. So essentially, you're going to compare the worst case change in your EVE, which is 1670, to 15% of the tier 1 capital, which for illustrative purposes we've taken as 1500. Which means in this case, the bank is actually breaching the 15% of the tier 1 capital, right? That means that if interest rates really move up parallelly tomorrow in this scenario, your net worth is going to deteriorate so significantly that even 15% of your tier 1 capital will not be able to absorb it, right? That means that the bank is going to be termed as an outlier bank, right? This is a regulatory requirement in most of the jurisdictions, which has very extensive and harsh penalties on most of the banks who fail this test, right? Similarly for NII, the banks do that as well, where they'll do the same thing for NII. And while NII is not used as a measure to see capital adequacy, it's used as a measure for capital buffers. Typically, most of the regulators across the globe have now started focusing on EVE more than NII from a pure capital adequacy perspective, right? So what we saw in the previous case study is that the EVE limits basically got busted and we have an outlier bank here. Now in this case study, the bank essentially had three ways of going about managing this interest rate risk, right? They could have either raised additional capital, right? But raising additional capital, firstly, is cumbersome. You need to go to investors, you need to do roadshows, it's not easy to raise new capital. And even if you do raise capital, it is going to reduce your ROE or your ROCE if you're not able to generate more return, right? So typically, banks choose raising additional capital as usually the last resort, or only when they're looking to expand significantly, when they know that the returns that they're going to make are going to be equivalent to the capital that they're raising, so that the ROE and the ROCE remains intact. The second option is balance sheet restructuring. The reason why we saw this significant amount of EVE outlier analysis happening and why the EVE limit got busted is because what we see is that there's a very bad mismatch in the equilibrium of the way the products are designed and sold in banks, right? And that's because these banks, most of the banks have been there around for years and products have evolved over a period of time, but these are really long-term contracts as well, right? So there could be like fixed rate borrowings that banks have been using to fund floating rate loans. Now, when that happens, there's a natural interest rate risk in your balance sheet, right, that you're running with. And that could be not because of the bank's fault. It just could be because that's how the market operates. The borrowing market maybe is only offering you fixed rate borrowings. And on the floating rate market, maybe customers are only open to floating rate loans, right? It could be that kind of a dynamic, right? Which basically leads to that EVE mismatch happening. So the second option the bank has is to look at the way the composition of their entire balance sheet and change the product design itself. But this is not easy. This is a very long-term ask, right? Because you're asking a bank to essentially change their business model. And it's not very straightforward to do from a short-term perspective, right? So you have raising additional capital, which is difficult, and balance sheet restructuring is not going to happen overnight, right? So essentially, the bank is left with very few choices left on the table on how to mitigate this risk, which is the third part, which is hedging this risk, right? Using interest rate derivatives, right? Now, hedging in itself is complicated. You need to get it right. But if done correctly, even though there's a cost of hedging involved, can be extremely beneficial in today's day and age for banks because it helps you preserve your net worth and also ensure stability in your earnings, right? And that's essentially what we're going to be focused on today in the next slide. So from a hedging perspective, there are different kind of derivatives that are used. There are forward rate agreements, IRFs, interest rate swaps, cross-currency swaps, caps and floors, swaptions, different plethora of interest rate derivatives that are available across the geographies. Some of the most common ones that we have seen are typically the IRS and the CCS and caps and floors, and also swaptions in the banking book. What we're going to be talking about is traditionally how an IRS typically works in this example. In this case, the bank had a fixed rate borrowing and a floating rate loan where they were paying a fixed rate of 5% on the fixed rate borrowing and they were receiving a floating rate of SOFR plus 2% on the interest floating rate asset, right? Now, what essentially happens is if the bank did not get into an IRS, they're running with an interest rate mismatch because the floating rate is on the floating, the assets are on the floating side, but the liability is on the fixed side. So they are automatically running an NII risk and also an EVE risk. But the moment they get into an IRS, what would happen is that the money that they receive from the asset, which is the receiving floating leg above, is used to pay the floating leg on the IRS, right? And the money that they receive on the IRS, which is the receive fixed, the 5% there, is used to pay the fixed on the borrowing. So it's a kind of a mirror position that the bank is taking using an interest rate swap to now ensure that whatever interest rate mismatch that they were running originally on the balance sheet, they're able to hedge that now using the interest rate swap, right? Of course, the nuances of interest rate swaps are a lot more difficult. I have simplified this extremely so that I can just explain the concept. But interest rate swaps are an extremely effective way if there is a liquid derivative market and there are OTC counterparties available to do that quote. It's a very effective instrument for interest rate risk hedging, right? So that's primarily what I wanted to cover from a second case study perspective. In the next slide, I'll just summarize in terms of the new age industry best practices that we are seeing, just so that I summarize what I spoke about, and then I'll hand it over to Arindam for closing remarks, and then maybe we'll just open up for Q&A, right? So today, as we say, ALM, IRRBB, liquidity risk have evolved over a period of time. It's not just a checkbox exercise anymore. Some of the best practices that we are seeing today across banks is using non-parallel shock scenarios, going above theoretical shock scenarios, incorporating macroeconomic behavioral modeling, which is your internal behavioral models are linked to macroeconomic variables as well and not just pure statistical data. Convexity adjustments on the duration side to get more accuracy on the interest rate risk measurement. ALM-driven budgeting and planning, which is more forward-looking view and a more dynamic view of ALM, which does not exist in the traditional ALM world. Optimization of contingency funding plans, we spoke about that, of how banks are now moving to contingency funding plans and its optimization. Aero optionality modeling, very important under IRRBB are embedded optionalities that are now being considered, which were not done earlier for net worth computations. Dynamic NII simulations from a forward-looking perspective. And lastly, usage of interest rate derivatives, as it's very critical in today's day and age to hedge and manage your ALM and liquidity risk well, right? That's essentially the second last slide. I'll now hand it over to Arindam for just the closing remarks, and then we'll open up for Q&A. Yeah.
Thanks, Yash. What we have seen today is everything from how risks are monitored to how, when let's say risks are exceeded beyond the risk appetite, how do we bring it back using hedging, using contingency plans on the liquidity right, liquidity risk side, so on and so forth. Now, if I break it down to how an institution would see it, right? Broadly, there are three or four functions involved. Treasury and risk is probably where it all starts. From that perspective, having the ability to know for sure that the metrics being computed are correct matters a lot. The modeling that is typically required, that also the complexity of the models, the need to update those on a regular basis. We have seen instances where, let's say, NMD modeling used for a certain product variant was used for another product variant, and that led to all kinds of inaccuracies. All of that becomes very important. The ability to know for sure that if I say EVE is X amount or my LCR is Y amount, that is correct, right? That assurance is a very basic one, and treasury and risk are usually the ones responsible for delivering that correctly. The second is from a finance function. The ability to see what my risk-adjusted profitability is across customers, across products, across regions, across legal entities, if it's a group structure, so on and so forth, becomes, again, extremely important. Someone like a JP does it really, really well. Because if you see, their finance function is a different legal entity, right? Their finance function is never part of the in-country bank. Right, and the reason they do it in that matrix structure is to ensure that there is risk-adjusted profitability owned by finance. The CEOs report into the CFOs. So it's a very, very nuanced approach over there. Right, so that's the second one from a finance perspective. Risk-adjusted profitability, absolutely key. The third is from a shareholder perspective. And finance slash investor relations becomes the interacting agency as far as shareholders goes. So making sure that they are able to see what my return on capital employed is, and most institutions today also benchmark with peers. Because all said and done, an investor in, let's say, one institution will want to see how do I fare vis-a-vis others. Right? So that peer benchmarking also is typically done. Now, all of these things together add up into a resilient balance sheet, right? It starts with risk management, then it moves on to profitability, then to your ROE management. And that is essentially what you see all over here, right? The starting point is where we have focused most of our attention today. We can obviously talk about the FTP, product pricing, profitability portions, for hours on end. But that effectively is what we wanted to cover here. Automation obviously becomes an important enabler. as a bank or a financial institution grows larger, the interconnectedness of, let's say, an ECL number with an ROE, all of that can be modeled only when you do some amount of automation. Practically not possible to do it on Excel or even on Python for that matter. Yeah? I think that's largely what we wanted to cover. We've gone maybe a couple of minutes overboard. Any questions, happy to take them, feedback, views, comments. I hope the session was useful. Would be good to get some feedback here.
I have a question with regards to, I think, the liquidity management part. So looking at how it's optimized, what would a bank prefer? Let's say that there is a higher cost versus a longer, you know, I'm trying to think, like lead time, right? From a cost versus a lead time, what would they prefer to be smaller? Because in your example, it seemed like the very last one had a higher of both.
Yeah.
But in a situation where the mismatch is not that high and they have to, you know, to take in some form of funding within like a space of very affordable funding with okay lead time, what would they prefer
to be smaller? If I mean, what we've seen is, if let's say the bank has only two options, the cost is more or less near each other. But I think the more important part is the lead time, because the entire point is we're not able to fill the gap. With that 2% yield up among, doesn't matter, the bank is not going to survive anymore. So surviving the bank comes first, right? Survival is the first and the most important part. Making that cost effective is an added bonus, right? But surviving is the most important part. So I think lead time will any day be more important than the cost. Of course, it can't be a cost which is crazy. But I mean, if it's reasonable, lead time will always be more important.
Okay. And then the second one would be, this is just a weird question maybe, but when they are hedging the interest rate risk, so is it for a big bank, which is usually most banks, it would have like the investment side of it and the retail side.
Right.
Would it be even riskier for the retail side to be hedged by the investment side of the bank? Is it too much risk within the structure of the bank, or they're just likely to, you know, hedge it with an outside counterparty?
So if I understand your question correctly, what you're essentially saying is that if there's a global bank which has both an investment banking function and a commercial banking function, right? Essentially, how would the risk interaction be? Is that the question?
Sorry?
So is the question that if it's a bank which is offering both investment banking as well as commercial banking, right? How would the interest rate derivative hedging work in that parlance?
No, I'm saying would they prefer like hedging within themselves?
Typically, no. The reason being because essentially you are the counterpart. But we have seen some large banks do that. It's an interesting question that you ask. Because some of the larger banks are operating their investment banking as a very different legal entity as well sometimes. Right? So when there are different legal entity compared to the commercial banking, it's essentially Chinese walls within the different legal entity structure. Okay. So they actually act like a market maker for the commercial banking arm, where they're offering quotes as them and they're the counterparty to that interest rate swap that we saw. But certain banks, typically the mid-sized banks are not large enough. They'll always go to a really large bank to be the counterparty. But when it's extremely large banks, we have seen that happening. But I think if the legal entities are separate, they have different funding profiles, there are proper Chinese walls in place with proper checks and controls, it's okay. But I think the moment where it's extremely interlinked, it's always better to go to an independent counterparty, because you're creating a very high concentration risk within your own portfolio inside. Mm. If you don't do that.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for the presentation. I just wanted to find out, from your perspective, how do you find that banks are managing the two metrics, NII and EVE? So in the case study example, we saw a breach on the EVE side, right? Your sensitivity exceeding 15% of your Tier 1 capital. So then you find out, then on the NII side, your NII sensitivity is
typically lower because the two metrics work in complementary or inverse of each other. So from your experience, I just wanted to find out, how do you find that banks are managing these two complementary metrics? Do they prefer, from your experience, are you seeing more focus on the EVE side or NII side? Because I think you mentioned earlier, you'd see or you'd find that shareholders are more concerned on the value side, yeah, and then banks are more concerned on the earning side.
Correct.
And then the second question, we are seeing that you mentioned that there's more focus on capital for EVE, right? And we know from a EBA perspective, or in Europe, they are focusing as well on capital for NII. Are there any other jurisdictions that you've engaged with or where you've picked up more focus on capital for NII? Thanks.
Perfect. I think very, very interesting question, very valid. I think for most of us, I think who just caught on to that, what you mentioned is a very important aspect. EV and NII are actually very inversely related to each other, and that's where ALM becomes extremely complicated. So if a bank tries to go to optimize their EVE, the way the measures are computed and the way they are, if it tries to completely optimize their EVE, it's going to take a very big hit on their NII. And if the bank tries to completely optimize the NII, it's going to completely destroy its EVE, right? So it's a balancing game. It's a art as well as a science of doing that. Typically how banks do it, EVE, up to before IRRBB came in, actually there were not really stringent regulatory requirements on EVE per se. Right, most of the stakeholders, there was a lot of focus on stakeholder expectations, and a lot of focus was on NII. Right, there wasn't really a talk about managing EV at that point in time. Since IRRBB has come in, this is the first time where this talk of balance has actually come into play. Right, where now banks understand the value of balancing both. Typically, the way we've seen it happen is that banks want to ensure that there's no regulatory breach, because if there are regulatory breaches, in a way, it will also indirectly impact your stakeholder expectations from a reputational risk perspective. Right. That's why getting your EVE limits under control have to be the first thing you got to ensure, right? Because if there's a regulatory breach, you're going to be penalized for it by the regulator, right? If you're hedging using interest rate derivatives, you have a lot more freedom and flexibility, right, to kind of preserve your net worth. And that gives you a lot more leeway to play around more with your NII, right, essentially. So the way we see banks doing it, if they're not using interest rate derivatives, they want to get their EVE limits in check first. That's non-negotiable, right? And then, of course, they try to optimize NII to the further extent possible, but without breaching the EVE limits, right? If they're using interest rate derivatives, there's a lot more leeway and room for banks to play around with their NII. But, of course, at the same time, hedging also reduces the upside from a earnings perspective as well. So it will kind of stable and kind of keep it in a ballpark rather than it being a very volatile NII that we're looking at. So I think that's the first question to what you answered. And the second one that you said is there capital kept for NII? In most of the jurisdictions that we've seen, you're right, Europe does ask for NII capital buffers to be there. Even in India, for example, RBI does ask the banks to keep NII for a capital buffer perspective, but the language and the tone of the regulation in most countries is it's a good to have over and above what you keep for EVE. EVE is definitely a must have, but NII is a good to have, at least up to this point in most jurisdictions. Maybe in the coming years, as experience matures, we might see that also becoming a must-have. But I think we'll have to wait to see that happen.
Can I just add something to what Yash mentioned? Typically, your NII-related capital add-on is a part of ICAP. It's not a part of your standard regulation per se, right? Whereas your EVE metric, that limit, is a part of that metric itself, the EVE guideline itself, right? So that is spelled out in black and white. The NII part of it is a little subjective, left to the bank. When the regulators come for their annual inspection or periodic inspections, they may mandate a certain add-on, right? And as far as that first question goes, see, EVE is a regulatory concern, NII is a shareholder concern, right? Because if there's no NII, I don't get ROE, right? So that balance effectively is where, at the beginning of the year, banks will construct a financial budget along with the funding strategy, which takes into consideration both of these aspects. Sure. Any other question? Or sure.
We'll have to take the questions, further questions offline.
Sure. Thanks, Yash and Arindam. Please give them a round of applause. Thanks for the session.